Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There is a three-story pile of black petroleum coke, pet coke, big enough to cover an entire city block, and it is piling up in southwest Detroit. This stuff is a byproduct of oil sands drilling from Alberta, Canada. On today's show, we ask, why is this high-sulfur, high-carbon waste piling up along the Detroit River? And then the Board of State Canvassers met today in Lansing. We're going to get an update on a petition drive to restrict abortion coverage and a referendum on the Michigan wolf hunt. But first, when one thinks of poverty in America, poverty in Michigan, what images come to your mind? Where are poor people living? Chances are an image of an inner city neighborhood first flashes in your mind. Well, that would be wrong. The Brookings Institute this week released its study. It's called Confronting Suburban Poverty in America. Bottom line, poverty is moving into the suburbs, both here in Michigan and all across the country. The suburbs are home to the largest and fastest growing poor population in the country. So joining me to talk about just what this study means in terms of how we think of poverty in our state is Scott Allard. He's an associate professor at the University of Chicago and a research affiliate at the National Poverty Center at the University of Michigan. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me, what do these new Brookings numbers tell us all about where poverty is living right now in Michigan?
Well, the Brookings reports focused primarily on southeast Michigan and the Detroit metro area, but some of the trends that it describes would be relevant in a lot of other urban areas in Michigan. The report talks about how Detroit, like many other cities, has seen a shift in the location of poor families and poor individuals over the last several decades. And today, as you noted, more poor people, people living below the federal poverty line, live in suburbs of Detroit than in the city of Detroit. And while this is relatively recent on our radar screen, these are trends that have been building for some time.
And what is behind this shift to the suburbs?
Right. Nationally, this phenomenon has happened, as I said, in most, if not all, metropolitan areas, and there's several factors that drive it. One is the significant change in our labor market, not only since the Great Recession, but changes that had been in place before then. Changes that have made it harder to find a good-paying job if you don't have a college degree. Changes that make it difficult to find a good-paying job if you don't have a car or are able to get around on public transit. Changes in the housing market have been a big factor in many communities. Not only have people lost value in their homes, but the industries related to the housing market, whether it's Home Depot and durable goods or contractors or landscapers, all kind of the home-related industries have taken a hit. Immigration is a big factor. Many immigrants to the U.S. today, legal immigrants to the U.S. today, are working but are working poor and increasingly locate in suburbs as opposed to cities. And that makes sense because suburbs have been a place where job growth has occurred in previous decades. And so, you know, there are more jobs in suburbs in many places than in cities for low-skill workers. And a final piece, and it depends on where you are. Detroit's actually a good example of this, that part of the trend has been families moving from central cities out to suburban areas, looking for better schools, safer neighborhoods, and other amenities that are desirable if you're trying to raise a family.
And I note that increased mobility of housing vouchers is a factor. Talk about that.
Yeah, so that's an issue that in Chicago we have been talking quite a bit about, and I'm sure there's some of this in Detroit, although I don't know the numbers off the top of my head. But as we've shifted from building kind of high-rise developments, public housing developments, and shifted away to a more of a voucher-based model, there's been a movement of housing assistance recipients into suburban communities, and they're moving for the same reasons that many people have moved. As I said, you know, safer schools, possibly, you know, greater job opportunities, better parks and recreational spaces. You know, so it's motivated by a lot of the same concerns that drive, you know, most everybody's housing decisions.
I'm speaking with Scott Allard, who's an associate professor at the University of Chicago and a research affiliate at the National Poverty Center at the University of Michigan, as we look at a Brookings Institute report called Confronting Suburban Poverty in America. Scott, can you give us a sense of what does poverty in Michigan look like compared to other states?
Well, the poverty rates in Detroit metro are much higher than in other metro areas. The city of Detroit, I think the poverty rate is close to 35%, and that's increased fairly significantly since 2000 and has been, you know, very high over the last several decades. By comparison, I think the poverty rate in Chicago is, you know, right around 20 or 22%. So you get a feel for kind of, you know, two comparable metro areas, kind of the differences there. The poverty rate in the suburbs of Detroit is much lower. And this is one of the important points to think about when you're looking at the changing geography of poverty, is that there may be more poor people in the suburbs of Detroit. And there are many more actually today than in the city.
So
the poverty
number
rate is much lower. It's only about 12% overall. Now you can find pockets in places near Pontiac, maybe in the western edge of Wayne County, maybe in some of the suburban communities just north of the city, where poverty rates may be, you know, well over 20%. But overall, in the suburban parts of the metro, the poverty rate is about a third as much as in the city itself.
Because so few people are living in the city, so the poverty rate is higher, but the total number of poor people is higher in the suburbs?
Right. So this is where Detroit is a little bit different than some other metros, where the city has actually lost quite a bit of population. And not just in the last 10 years, but over the last 40 years. And the suburban population grew extensively, you know, between the 60s and, well, the 40s and 50s, but, but picking up speed in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And so what is happening in Detroit is not only do you have people moving out of the city, but you actually have a fairly large suburban population that's just becoming poorer. So some of this is driven by people moving out. Some of it is driven just by people who have been suburban residents becoming poor, losing a job, not being able to find work. The fact that many people have moved out of Detroit have meant that those who are left behind are often those with the fewest resources and maybe least likely to move or to be able to have choices to move. And that's why the poverty rate is so much higher in the city, in addition to all the other economic factors that are in place.
And Grand Rapids was included in this Brookings Institute report. I note the 14.3% increase in urban poverty was the highest of the 95 urban areas studied in the whole report, and a 5.8% increase in suburban poverty.
Yeah, those numbers really reflect what I think you see in the western part of the state, where you have smaller urban centers or municipalities that have seen very significant increase in poverty over the last decade. You know, again, these are trends that have been building for some time. And that's starting to spill out into areas just outside these smaller cities, in places that you know, really we don't think of as having a poverty problem.
Scott, I want to ask you, why do you think the myth of suburban prosperity has been such a stubborn one?
Right. Well, it's an interesting question. And the Brookings report and the reports in the book get at this, but I think this is something that scholars are talking quite a bit about as well. When you think about the history of poverty in the U.S., particularly in the post-war era, we think of poverty as being primarily an urban or a rural phenomenon.
Right.
And you can see this when you look back at discussions in the War on Poverty in the 60s. Work by Michael Harrington, the book The Other America, focused largely on cities and urban poverty and on rural poverty. And the myth of suburbs, as you kind of noted, the myth of suburbs is one of homogeneity and prosperity, kind of, you know, predominantly white, predominantly affluent areas. And that never was really true, but that was the kind of the pop cultural myth. And you see it actually in shows like Mad Men, where frankly people talk about the city of New York, where the show is shot, as being kind of a dangerous place, and the suburbs, you know, in the 60s and when the show is at now, the suburbs are safe, you know, wealthy places. Well, that never was completely true. And you can find, evidence of this. It's just that our popular imagery was very different than the reality. And I think it's been hard for us to push past that, because those myths and narratives powerfully shape how media covers poverty. It powerfully shapes the ideas we have about what it means to be poor and who is poor. And what the Brookings reports push us to think about is really a reconsideration of this and a change perhaps in our discourse around poverty in America, that poverty is not just a central city phenomenon. It's not something that only affects racial or ethnic minorities, but it's something that actually is a phenomenon that affects families all over our areas, urban, suburban, and rural, and affects people that many of us know. It's not something that's just isolated from our daily experience anymore.
And is there, even if it's unconscious, a strong streak of racism behind all of this?
Well, I think it's hard to disentangle the stereotypes about poverty and race. And in our country, the popular imagery and the popular and some of the rhetoric around poverty issues is heavily race coded. And I think one of the challenges moving forward is for us to have a discussion about what do we do now that poverty is starting to increase in a dramatic fashion in suburban areas. How do we solve these issues? And part of the challenge we'll face in doing this is there still are real deep racially segregated issues of poverty in central cities. And so it's not just a matter of funneling resources away from cities into suburbs. You know, even though poverty has increased dramatically in suburbs, it hasn't gone away in cities. Mm. So one of the challenges we'll face as a society and as metro areas and as states is how do we address these issues in a way that still recognizes that there's a lot of need that remains in cities, but at the same time tries to think about how we can provide low-income suburban residents with the resources and the programs they need to grab the next rung on the ladder.
Scott Allard's associate professor at the University of Chicago, and he's a research affiliate of the National Poverty Center at the University of Michigan. Scott, thank you for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
Tomorrow night brings Game 4 in the Western Conference semifinals between the Detroit Red Wings and arch rivals Chicago Blackhawks. The Wings handed the Blackhawks a pair of stinging losses in Games 2 and 3, so tomorrow night's game at the Joe finds the Wings up 2-1. John Keating covers the Red Wings for Fox Sports Detroit, and he has done so for many years. He has seen this team through its ups, its downs, its thicks, its thins. John, thanks for talking with us today.
Well, I wasn't there at the beginning of hockey. Almost the beginning of hockey, but yes, I've been around the block a couple of times.
You've seen the evolutions in this team since the ones we all took for granted that just win Stanley Cups.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was growing up in Detroit, and I can remember when they were the dead things, and nobody, you know, they had to give away a car to get people to come to the rink, and then I moved away to Colorado, and I came back just at the evolution of the teams that won it all in '97 and '98, and then to see them sort of piece this thing together this year with a team that didn't have that it factor. They didn't have Nicklas Lidström. I mean, let's be honest. So you weren't sure what you were going to get, but now all of a sudden I think people are paying attention. This is a great little story that's brewing, and even if the Wings don't get past Chicago, we hope that they do, but even if they don't, this is already a really cool story because they had to scramble their way to make the playoffs. They went up against an Anaheim team that nobody really expected them to beat. And now they're giving Chicago all they want, three games into the Western Conference semifinals, and who knows what might happen from this point forward.
And we watched Chicago just power its way, you know, right into the playoffs with that President's Trophy in hand, and we weren't even sure the Wings were going to be in the playoffs till pretty much the last couple of games. So did you really expect to see what we all saw in Games 2 and 3 of this series against Chicago?
You know, I knew that they had more than we saw in Game 1. I mean, that was a flat effort, but you know, they had three trips to Anaheim to finish off the Ducks, and with all the travel, and they were playing every other night, and even Mike Babcock said after Game 1, he knew the day before when they had a practice that they had nothing. They had no juice, they had no jump, they didn't have any legs, and they were actually hanging around in Game 1. It was a 1-1 game going into the third period, and so they had the chance to steal one. That didn't happen. But he knew that this team was sort of coming on, and that they'd have a better effort in Game 2. They really dominated Game 2. And then, you know, the Game 3 at the Joe, the first game in this series at home, that place was as loud as I've heard it probably since the McCarty-Lemieux era. And, you know, to a degree, the Wings were feeding off that. And I think, you know, as I mentioned, I think people, you know, see this as sort of a little team that can. Perhaps, mm-hmm. And it's a really cool story.
John, are you surprised how physical the Wings have gotten in the series with Chicago? I mean, it's even more than I think than with Anaheim. Like, if it moves, they're hitting it.
Well, that's a part of playoff hockey. And you know, if you don't do that, you're dead. I mean, you really, really have to deliver the hit. You have to take the hit. There's a very fine line between what's dirty and what's fair come playoff time. So that's, you know, that's part of playoff hockey. But that's really why we like playoff hockey. I mean, there is a tension about these games that is truly something special. I actually was standing with one member of the Red Wings front office at the end of the game the other night, and at that point the Wings are leading by 2 goals, and he said, to Detroit sporting fans, playoff hockey is what it's like watching Papa Grande try to finish off the game for the Tigers, because you have no idea how well it's going to go or not go at game's end. And the drama is what we love about sports, and that's why we hang around till the end.
And the big question is, John Keating, can they keep it up?
Well, that's a good question. Momentum is a great thing, and they're coming. I mean, and they feel like they haven't played their best hockey yet. They know. I'm sure they're bracing themselves for what will be an absolute desperate band of Blackhawks tomorrow night. If the Wings win Game 4 and take a 3-1 lead back to Chicago, well, then all of a sudden the Wings become the favorite. So the Wings know that they're going to get Chicago's top effort in Game 4. Can they keep it up? Sure. Will they? Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. John Keating covers the Red Wings for Fox Sports Detroit. John, thanks for sharing your Red Wing insight with us today on Stateside.
Happy to do it, Cindy, anytime.
There's something growing along the Detroit River in southwest Detroit. That something is a three-story pile of black petroleum coke that's big enough to cover an entire city block. The pet coke piling up in southwest Detroit's a byproduct of oil sands drilling in Alberta, Canada, more than 2,000 miles to the north. It's high-sulfur, high-carbon waste that's a dirty, inefficient energy source. So why is this Canadian oil waste piling up alongside the Detroit River in southwest Detroit? That question drew the attention of the New York Times. Ian Austin is the Canada correspondent for the New York Times. His story on the pet coke pile was published earlier this month. Ian Austin joins us now from Ottawa, and good to have you with us, Ian.
Hi, Cindy.
So you describe the Black Mountain of pet coke in wonderful terms as the unloved, unwanted, and long overlooked product of Canada's oil sands boom. So before we get into how it came to live in southwest Detroit, tell us exactly what this stuff is.
Well, all heavy oil and oil sands bitumen, which is what it starts out as, it's not oil at the beginning, is the heaviest of the heavy oils, needs to have basically its thickest gunk removed before you can refine it. It would gum up any refinery otherwise. So with the case of the oil, most of the oil sands production, they're run through a process called coking, which at the end produces something that looks like tiny pellets of coal. They're basically the heaviest waste of the bitumen. And at that point, it's then called synthetic crude and it can be refined. People didn't pay much attention to this because historically the coking was done in northern Alberta before the product left Canada. And it's been going on for so long, there are piles measured in hundreds of millions of tons in Alberta, which they once thought was going to be a great energy source. Now the only thing they can think of doing with it is filling in the open pit mines from the oil sands.
Wow. So it's that inefficient and dirty as an energy source.
It's like the cheapest thing you can get to have a fire, basically. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't actually burn that well. You usually have to mix it with real coal. Of course, it's not very good from a greenhouse gas perspective because coke is virtually carbon. It's basically a pure lump of carbon. Now, that's good. When you steel, one of the ingredients in steel is carbon. So the steel industry actually needs coke and makes it. When you make aluminum, you make the anodes that zap it, the bauxite with electricity, out of pure carbon, and that's great too. The problem with this stuff is it's not the right size, and it has way too much sulfur for those useful purposes for coke. So it's just kind of junk coke.
As you say, unloved and unwanted.
Yeah.
And it's been clearly for most everybody out of sight, out of mind up in Alberta. And now, how is it that we've got this big growing pile of pet coke in southwest Detroit?
Well, as probably some of your listeners know, Enbridge, a Canadian pipeline company, did some rejigging of one of its lines, and it's now bringing oil sands bitumen directly from the oil sands into Michigan. A refinery owned by Marathon Petroleum in Detroit spent several billion dollars to on a general upgrade, which included a coker so that it could handle this bitumen from the oil sands and process it.
And that refinery, anybody who's driven along I-75, we've all seen the Marathon refinery. It's been around since the 1930s. So it was business for the refinery.
Yeah, it's a cheaper. I mean, the thing about oil sands, because they have to go through this extra process, like any heavy oil, they're a cheaper feed source for a refinery. Yeah, you get oil sands, bitumen at a discount relative to very, very light oil that doesn't need coking.
All right. So now, because this is being processed, the oil sands are being processed at the Marathon plant, like the folks in northern Alberta that have been looking at piles of pet coke, now we have our own pile of pet coke, right?
Yeah, of course, the piles of pet coke in northern Alberta are where nobody can see them.
Yes.
Yes. So this is a very, very different thing. I mean, the pet coke isn't piling up in downtown Edmonton or downtown Calgary. It's out in the middle of nowhere.
And here it is, piling up on the southwest side of Detroit, right near the Ambassador Bridge, right near downtown Detroit. Why?
Well, because the refinery, of course, can't keep it forever. There's no issue with how the refinery is handling this material. It contains it properly. You can't actually see it. The refinery is selling it to a company controlled by the Koch brothers. And they, in turn, have contracted a company called Detroit Bulk to handle this stuff for them. And they're handling, I think, putting it... generously has been somewhat inadequate. They're storing it uncovered on the banks of the Detroit River. They did not apply, as they should have, for a required permit to do this in the first place. Getting that permit is a process that involves public hearings and so on. Mm. So there's a big mountain of it piling up there. Now, Detroit Bulk wouldn't speak with me. Koch confirmed that they're buying it from the refinery, but wouldn't tell me who in turn is going to buy it from them. But there are a number of scenarios. Often this stuff ends up going to China, to India, to Mexico, where there aren't tight emission controls. Mm-hmm. And it's used to make electricity and add to Beijing's infamous air pollution, or to make cement, particularly in Latin America.
So clearly Koch Carbon and therefore Charles and David Koch are going to be able to make money. They feel they can make money off this pet coke. And we should note that the Koch brothers are well known for challenging the science behind climate change. We'll just say that. You quote in your story in the New York Times, Ian, State Representative Rashida Tlaib. We've had her on Stateside often. Her comment to you was how disturbing it was. Here's her words. Some companies treat the city of Detroit as a dumping ground. Fair comment?
Well, I mean, there's certainly the way this company's handled it doesn't meet any rules. That's pretty clear. The humorous thing about all this, and why, aside from the fact I covered the oil sands, I wrote about this story, is that Rashida Tlaib found out about the pile from people in Windsor, Ontario, environmental activists there. Though she has an office quite near it, buildings blocked her view of it, but the pile is profoundly obvious from the Windsor side of the river.
So they can't be happy either, the folks at Assumption Park looking across and looking at this. Is there anything head of steam growing in Windsor to do something about this, if anything could be done?
Well, in fact, the issue was initially raised by Canadians who were looking at this thing. Whatever Detroit's troubles, the view of its skyline from Windsor is still very dramatic,
yes.
As is the view of the bridge. And now there's this big black blob sitting in the middle of it, which, as I mentioned earlier, has no dust abatement program at the moment, and there are concerns that some of it is running off into the river. So the local member of parliament, Brian Massey, asked the Canadian government to contact the International Joint Commission, which sort of deals with cross-border pollution disputes, to launch an investigation into this. The response I received from the government of Canada is that they're aware of it and they think it's Michigan's jurisdiction.
Hmm. Now, I will say we just noted yesterday that U.S. Congressman John Conyers and Gary Peters sent out another letter. They've been kind of on this, asking the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality to look into whether the company storing the pet coke, so that would be Detroit Bulk Storage, is within state regulations. So that leads to the question that I'm sure if you're living in southwest Detroit, you're wondering, is this stuff toxic to the health of the people who have to live around it?
I don't think it's as such toxic. There's no evidence of that. But obviously having any sort of airborne pollutant is undesirable and can have health impacts. And having any kind of exogenous material like this run into any part of the Great Lakes is also not desirable, which is why the state has demanded that Detroit Bulk come up with a better storage system at the site.
Hmm. So there's a lot of demanding going on. You weren't able to get anyone to say what they're planning to do and when with that pile. And then you point out in your story in the New York Times, Ian, that the petcoke pile in Detroit may not be the only one eventually because of the impending Keystone XL pipeline. So there are other places in America that could eventually enjoy their own petcoke pile?
Well, in fact, there's a much larger refinery renovation underway in Indiana right now that will have what the company claims to be the second largest coker in the world. So there will be even greater amounts of petcoke coming out of that refinery. One of the whole things about Keystone XL is shipping more bitumen and less synthetic crude oil to the United States. Oil companies in Canada have basically stopped investing in cokers because it's not a great business, so they're shipping the business down there. Now, some of it will be a wash. Keystone XL could take bitumen right down to the Gulf Coast, where refineries have long had cokers to deal with heavy oils from Mexico, Venezuela, places like that. So I guess, you know, unless those refineries considerably increase their output after they start using oil sands oil, that won't be an additional layer of petroleum coke piling up in the U.S. But certainly the refinery, things like the Marathon refinery and the refinery renovation in Indiana mean petcoke in places it's never been before.
So, Ian, what will you be watching for going forward, and what should we watch for, especially for the folks listening to us who live in Southwest Detroit with this petcoke pile as their unloved neighbor?
Well, I guess one of the long-term things that people I interviewed from the environmentalist side of this whole thing are concerned about is what this means for weaning the United States off of coal-fired hydroelectricity, which is, of course, one of the country's major problems in terms of generating greenhouse gases. You can't get a license now to burn petcoke, but if you have a license, a permit to burn it, you can continue to use it. And in fact, there's a Detroit Edison refinery in Monroe, just down the river from this pile, that is licensed to use petcoke. As far as I could determine, it isn't at the moment, though. But here's this really cheap junk that the refineries just want to get rid of. If you're making electricity, it's going to be awfully tempting to burn it rather than invest a huge amount of money to convert your electrical plant to natural gas.
And then the other thing that I think, as we've talked about, you have Charles and David Koch, who are basically dumping this pile on the riverside in Detroit and haven't bothered getting permits and things that would be required.
Yeah, the company they've chosen
yes.
to handle this material doesn't seem to be dealing with it in a very professional way. Now, Representative Tlaib is hoping that there'll be an order issued that they've just got to get rid of the pile and then go through the whole process of application. So we'll see. That may be the next step, although where that pile will disappear to is a bit of a mystery at the moment.
Ian Austin is the Canada correspondent for the New York Times. His story on the petcoke pile was published earlier this month. We have put a link to his New York Times story on our website at michiganradio.org. He was kind enough to join us from Ottawa, Canada. Ian, it was good talking with you. Thank you so much.
Likewise, Cindy. Thank you.
The Board of State Canvassers met today in Lansing and took up two controversial issues, one involving abortion coverage, the other wolf hunting in Michigan. With us now is Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Networks, Rick Pluta. He was at the meeting. Hi, Rick.
Hello, Cindy.
So a quick primer for all of us. Remind us exactly, what is the job of the Board of State Canvassers?
Sure. The Board of State Canvassers is a four-person bipartisan panel to Democrats, to Republicans. It deals with all things that deal with elections and petition drives, and anything it does requires a majority that includes at least one person from each party to get anything done. And today it was dealing with petition drives.
Okay, so the board, Rick, gave the go-ahead to a petition drive that would enact a restriction on abortion coverage. And this was a restriction vetoed last year by Governor Snyder. Tell us what's going on here.
Sure. Yeah, this was a ban on insurance companies, including abortion coverage for most abortions. There'd be an exception for saving the life of a woman. But other than that, a ban on abortion coverage in basic insurance policies. It was part of the Blue Cross overhaul that the legislature enacted last year at the behest of Governor Snyder. The governor vetoed that because he said that particular provision, that abortion provision, was too cruel to women who become pregnant by rape or if they have some other medical need for abortion, something that would deal with another health condition. The legislature then sent the governor a new version of that legislation without the abortion restriction in it. And now what Right to Life is doing is they're trying to initiate a law that would reenact that that restriction.
So in order for this measure to be brought in front of the legislature, Right to Life needs to gather more than 250,000 signatures. Then what happens?
258,000 signatures. That's 8% of the people who voted in the last gubernatorial election. And if they gather those signatures of registered voters, once it's certified by the Board of State Canvassers, then the question goes to the legislature, which has 40 days to act on it. If the legislature does not act on it, then it goes on the ballot. If the legislature rejects it, it goes on the ballot. But the legislature could also put another question, a competing question, on the ballot on the same issue. But since the legislature has already voted for this, it seems highly likely that what the legislature is going to do is adopt it if and when Right to Life turns in its petition signatures. And what the legislature does then with this petition drive could not be vetoed by the governor. It becomes a law on a majority vote of the House and the Senate and is immune to a gubernatorial veto.
So if you're watching this, no matter which side of the issue you're on, and you're watching this intently, how likely is it Right to Life can get this all done?
Well, Right to Life has done it three times before, that there's a ban on Medicaid-funded abortions that was an initiated law enacted via a petition drive in 1987. In 1990, there was the parental consent for abortion law, another petition drive initiated law. And then there was in 2004, there was a law enacted to outlaw the procedure that opponents call partial birth abortion. And all of those were done by Right to Life-led petition drives to initiate a law.
Okay, Rick, let's move on to wolves, because the Board of State Canvassers certified petition signatures today by that group, Keep Michigan Wolves Protected. But now a law recently signed by Governor Snyder is written in such a way that it would circumvent that group's effort to prevent a wolf hunt in Michigan. So can you piece together what's going on here for us?
Oh, sure. Let's start with last year. The legislature enacted a law to allow the State Natural Resources Commission, it's an appointed wildlife management, among other things, commission, to start a wolf hunting season. And it's gone through the research and development process. And in the meantime, the Humane Society of the United States led a drive to call a referendum on that law. And then once they turned in the petition signatures and it appeared that this was going to be certified for the ballot, which would suspend the law that lawmakers from the Upper Peninsula introduced another bill that would change how wildlife is managed in Michigan. And as part of that, it included the wolf in the list of game species that could be hunted. That was sent to the governor, who signed it. And the day after that, the State Natural Resources Commission authorized a hunt in the Upper Peninsula to take place in November of this year.
But that is a lot of stuff to follow. So here's what we're wondering. Do we know?
We do it so you don't have to.
Thank you. We thank you for that. So do we know what Keep Michigan Wolves Protected is going to do next?
Well, they're going to move ahead with their referendum. It's on the ballot now. And so they're going to do their, you know, they're going to launch their political campaign along with that. The question is, what are they going to do vis-a-vis this second law that still allows the wolf hunt? They could go to court and say that this was not done according to Hoyle and that they ought to wait for the November 2014 election. They could also put together another referendum campaign to challenge this second law.
So that law has not been made referendum-proof by putting any money in there, right?
No, actually, it was temporarily. It came out of committee that way, but there was such a hue and cry over it that this referendum-proofing by trying to make them budget bills by putting appropriations in them has been used a lot, and there was such a hue and cry over how often it's been used that the Senate stripped it out and sort of and sent it to the governor and just hoped for the best.
So basically said, oh, never mind about that.
Yes. As a matter of fact, the sponsor of the bill apologized to his colleagues for putting them in that position, and then sponsored the amendment that that stripped it out. So we could see two wolf hunting referendums on the November 2014 ballot by the time it's all said and done.
Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, keeping track of all of these ins and outs and ups and downs so we don't have to. Rick, thank you so much for talking with us again.
The things I've seen. Thank you, Cindy.
Well, here's a question that colleges and universities across the nation are grappling with. How does liberal arts fit into our futures? We hear more and more talk about STEM courses and careers, science, technology, engineering, math. There's a lot of talk about the fact that the United States needs people with these degrees to compete in a global economy. So what will it take for liberal arts programs to matter to students who want to graduate with degrees that will secure a job that pays? These are some of the questions being tackled this week at a major conversation involving more than 50 deans at large research universities around the nation, gathering at the University of Michigan for an unprecedented national conversation, the focus being the liberal arts and sciences in the research university today, histories, challenges, futures. And joining me here in the studio is the Dean of the College of Literature, Science, and the Arts at the University of Michigan, Dean Terrence McDonald. Good to have you in the studio with us today.
Happy to be here.
Why was it so important to have this conversation right now?
Well, I think if you've been looking at the newspaper headlines and heard, for example, the proposals of various governors of states to charge more for degrees outside of the STEM fields, for example, you've heard a conversation about the liberal arts, which has, to a great extent, said they're really not important, not relevant for the future of the country. Now, this is ironic. So the United States invented a four-year liberal arts education. But, of course, now that's the fastest growing such educations are in Britain and China. So the Chinese are flocking to a liberal arts background at the same time as we're thinking about charging more for students who actually want to study them.
Why are they flocking? Why is that? Why is it looking good overseas?
The overseas people believe that the foundation of creativity is in intellectual choice, breadth, and perspective. And they believe that the liberal arts provide more of that, actually, than the more narrow technical fields.
So We're seeing these headlines. We're seeing these stories of STEM careers and charging more. Let's talk a little about some history. Talk to us, if you can, Dean, about the standing and the message of liberal arts and sciences courses. How has it evolved in our universities over the years?
So the education that we recognize today really began in the United States in the 1890s, approximately. So the University of Michigan, for example, we were one of the first. The literary college is one of the first units of the university here. That was us, medicine, and law were the first three colleges of the University of Michigan. There was an older curriculum called the classical curriculum, where students basically all studied the same text. But in the 1880s, 1890s, that was broken down, and the new idea was that students would study a wide variety of disciplines with some requirements to focus in certain areas. And then after that, actually, what we come to recognize as the major was actually invented. So the liberal arts began as complete choice across the curriculum at the major universities, and then gradually there was this idea of specialization in a particular field. Since then, of course, that's pretty much been the model for the liberal arts. The key thing is 4 years of non-professional preparatory education, for example, which is untrammeled by any particular – the student gets to choose what they're going to study. And that has been seen to be the great kind of source of creativity and preparation for a very, very fast-changing life.
So as we hear political leaders or we hear pundits saying, oh, they need to be trained to meet the needs mm-hmm. of business and let's charge more because the kids are graduating and can't find work with that history degree, how do you answer that?
Well, I like to joke with people who make that comment and ask them, do you believe in market timing with your investments? This is a kind of market timing. Now, in fact, if you ask a financial advisor, what's the best way to invest your money? Go for the long haul. Don't try to time the market. Don't try to pick an investment that's going to pay off in a very short time. I would say the same thing about education. The one thing that we know is there's going to be ceaseless change going forward, and that what's really hot today may be very cold in 10 years. So the idea of timing the market with your education is a huge mistake. In reality, the future is going to be constant change. You don't know what you're going to be doing. Americans change jobs. They used to change jobs 7 times over the course of a career. It's even more now in the wake of the recession. So the fact is you can't predict the future, but one thing you can say is good communication skills, historical and geographical perspective, and some kind of focus in a particular area that's giving you intellectual discipline, these will all be crucially important skills no matter what happens in the economy.
And how do they translate into the jobs that are available today?
Well, again, I think that if you ask employers, and there recently was a survey done by the American Association of Colleges and Universities, what kind of skills are you looking for? They're looking for good communication skills, which is essentially writing and speaking. They're looking for the ability to work with teams, which is essentially the understanding of diversity that perspective brings with it. And they're looking for people who are independent thinkers. This is what the ideal employee is like today. That's exactly the kind of education that you're going to get in the liberal arts and basic sciences.
So can the leaders and faculty, you're pulling people together from all over, can they help define a new role or a new look for liberal arts?
Well, I want to say I think they're going to be reasserting the old role. In other words, that there's two ways to approach the current conversation. One is to say, yes, you're right. You know, we're irrelevant. We have to get relevant. The other is to say, we've always been relevant. And I think that there's going to be quite a bit of conversation about how do we make the case for the continuing relevance of what has been the most uniquely American form of college education in the world, which is the four-year liberal arts degree?
I know we had a young woman who had been through liberal arts. She actually graduated with a degree in the classics with a hope to go on to work in museums. She found herself unemployable, had much student debt. She was sharing the story. We were actually looking at student debt. And she was sharing the story of falling behind, ignoring the warning letters. Now she's in so much financial trouble that the idea of going on and getting that necessary doctorate to be able to work at a museum is just not there. What do students and their parents need to do, Dean, as they're choosing courses? Because it struck me that of all the many offerings in liberal arts, maybe you do like the classical studies, but is that going to find you a job in 2013 in Michigan?
You have one and only one chance to do what you love during 4 years in your life, and that's when you're an undergraduate student. So my first advice to parents is, if you can afford it, the very best gift you can give your child is an untrammeled choice about what they want to study. Let them do what they love for once in their life. There's going to be 50 more years when they're not going to be able to do that. So that's one thing that's very important. Moreover, don't prejudge what your child should be studying. Too many parents are saying, oh, what about accounting? What about this? When their student really wants to study anthropology. In other words, there's a gift that can be given by parents if they can afford to do this, which is this kind of choice. Now, it is true that students have to be cautious about debt. And different institutions handle that differently. Mm-hmm. At the University of Michigan, half of our students graduate with no debt, and the average debt is around $20,000. Now, what I say to parents is, if you're going to buy your student a car, how much do you think you'd pay for that first car, which would depreciate the day that you drove it off the lot? Well, of course, you couldn't get one for less than $20,000. So a little bit what we're talking about here is the value on investment. And my argument would be that it's a tremendously valuable investment to have a four-year degree in the liberal arts and sciences, once again, because it is an unchanging world out there, not necessarily the jobs that exist today that will be your career or be your life.
But I guess I'll just ask, thinking of that kid who said, I love anthropology, because I loved archaeology, so I can totally relate to a youngster that said, I want to take classical studies and I want to take anthropology. And then I look at the businesses growing in our state and across our country. Will they find a job? Will they need to buy more education to make them more employable?
Well,
they've had their good 4 years, you know, following their passions. But
sure. What
about the practical payoff?
You know, if you talk to someone, if you talk to employers about the kind of person they're looking for, they will often say, "Look, we can teach them the business. What we want is a person who can experience passion." Now, that can happen in a lot of areas, but a kind of burning desire to study a field that you love is a practice for the kind of passion that people out there in the market really want to see in their employees today. In a sense, the appropriate preparation for that is this first stage of passionate engagement with ideas, with periods, with the past, with the future, whatever the case may be. And I think that's a place that happens a lot in the education and the basic liberal arts and sciences. You know, I think we also, for example, let's take the CERN, the accelerator in Europe now, that's where they're having these big discoveries about physics. I mean, there's, you know, people say, well, that's great. We discovered the Higgs boson. What's the relevance of it? Well, of course, it has no relevance. It's a confirmation of a theoretical model that physicists believe explains the whole world. But someone working at CERN isn't necessarily going to be prepared for a job at a semiconductor company.
The conversation and the big convention in sense of leaders from colleges and universities across the country looking at the future of liberal arts and sciences coming together at U of M. Do you fear for the future of liberal arts if conversations like these are not held?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in the last year or two, to some extent, driven by the recession, in particular, the conversations of political leaders who have been suggesting that there should be a discount on certain fields of study and it should be more expensive, for example, to study history than to study math. This is perhaps an appropriate response to a cyclical downturn in the economy. It's a colossally mistaken way to think about education over the long run.
Well, everybody coming together, and there will be public forums, a couple of public forums available tonight and tomorrow night. And we're going to put the link up on our website at michiganradio.org, and you can go to the stateside link and get a link to take you to all the information about this big conference happening this weekend. Dean Terrence McDonald, University of Michigan College of Literature, Science, and the Arts. As a history major, I'll say I'm there. I get that. And it's a good conversation to have, and we're glad you're doing it.
Thank you.